Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a little extract from a work I'm doing at the moment. It's written in the form of letters, and each letter begins "Dear Principal." It's just a story of this girl who works in the school. She's an upper class girl, and it's an inner city school, and it's pretty rough, and she really can't cope with it. So she writes these letters to the principal, and he's hopeless as well. He doesn't, he's no help at all for her. So she ends up writing these letters in the classroom to him. And whether she intends to send them to him or just to keep her own sanity, I haven't decided yet. Anyway, St. Ghetto High, Sisters of Holy Martyr, Secondary School. Dear Principal, 9:15 a.m. I am writing from room 13, where I am currently with class 382 for a double French period. There have been no further signs of hypodermic syringes, so there is no need to be concerned on that front. The whole AIDS thing is very overblown anyway, I think. I wonder if you could nonetheless find the time to come down to the classroom? Small difficulty has arisen. Thank you. P.S. Immediately. Yours, etc., maybe go no. And in brackets, substituting for Mr. Don, recently diseased. Oh no, is it deceased? Both even. Something he can't from the children, was it? Second letter. Dear Principal, 9:20. Thank you for not replying to my earlier letter. Your intervention almost certainly would not have helped, judging from your past performance anyway. I was sorry, though hardly surprised, to discover that you were not available. Should your presence ever be required in a serious emergency, I shudder to think how difficult it might prove to be to locate you. Anyway, the difficulty I had earlier was with a pupil called John Evans, but now that he has come back in the window, the danger has passed. For the moment, anyway. Dear Principal, 9:20. Excuse me for this. I seem to be. Dear Principal, thank you for not replying again. Your intervention almost. No, I'm sorry. I think I repeated the same sheet. I'll just finish with this. 9:27. Oh, yes. He's come back in the window, you see? 9:27. I have interrogated John. He has informed me that the window ledge proved to be too high up from the ground to risk jumping, so he decided to return to the classroom again. 9:30. I wonder if you know Boney O'Connor, Barry O'Connor. He is the thin boy with the hedgehog hair who was involved in that fracas in the yard yesterday. The one who threw the milk carton at Mr. Burns. Ring a bell? I know he missed. He has appalling aim. He is the worst pupil at basketball I've ever seen. And I suppose, to be fair, he did later remove the banana from Miss Walsh's hair. But certainly in retrospect, I do think some corrective action might have been taken. Oh, and by the way, just now as I write, he has Robert O'Driscoll pinned into the wall and is striking him about the head. What should I do? Would you be available to come to class now? Or should I intervene myself? Perhaps I could bring the police directly? An ambulance, maybe? What do you think? The coroner's hardly necessary yet. Should I show some initiative here? 9:37. I think I will. Yours, etc., Mabel Donnell, acting substitute teacher of English, French, and good manners, but not in that order.
Next up, someone we've all missed for the past couple of weeks. Yeah. The All the way from Missouri, Jennifer Matthews.
If you'll indulge a poem I've read before here. Changeability. Clouds are formed from his small grievances, granite drops floating above daily outer life, like going to the shop for bread, like driving children home. This is how rain works. Your sins are at a maximum capacity, and the collective body gives, sheeting down gray blankets, making veils of clingy hair, testing the integrity of skin as an organ of protection. On soap days, you can dry, you can conjure fires, but there remains the skeletal cold, the core structure shivering after his unprovoked baptism. And real quick, the discussion group is using we know that next week is in next week, I've got two sheets left, but you're always welcome to show up whenever you want, 8 o'clock. There's one sheet left. But, okay, I got distracted, excuse me. So you're always welcome to show up at 8 o'clock. Somebody's always got an extra sheet and you can read quickly and discuss with us. It's very relaxed, and what I do is combine a classic poet with a new poet. The classic one is Robert Frost, After Apple Picking, and The Thawing Wind. And on the other side, something that The Guardian on Saturday named as one of the poets to watch out for as a new and upcoming poet. She's teaching in Belfast, I think. Forgive my pronunciation, Leontia Flynn?
Leontia, yeah.
Leontia Flynn. So I'm going to read one of hers. Pisces, come along at 8 o'clock next week to discuss the poems. This one is called The Acts of Faith, and it's not by me, it's by this lady, Leontia Flynn. Acts of Faith. On my 24th birthday, my lungs closed over, tied to the baby's fist, around its first rattle. It might be the Holy Ghost, the disc of light skittering on the ceiling, thrown up from the patent of a water glass which my mother brings with present down. She sings, happy birthday, and tells me, as she has always done, that she would take my place. I believe her.
Night, how are you? This is a very short story. It's called Be Careful What You Wish For. That was the last year of the Paris-Dakar rally. What put an end to it was the increasing practice of hijacking the cars by means of various ingenious tire deflating devices. Of the hundreds of thousands of migrants who reached the North African coast looking for boats, some arrived in style, having dodged the cops, and somehow on the way learned how to drive Maseratis, Citroëns, and Mercedes with their tires and ribbons. SUVs had been banned by the rally organizers. That year, Jean Dubois was in the lead in his souped-up high-suspension Mercedes 500 SL when things started to go wrong. He had always prided himself on his way with technology, so he was particularly pleased when his pride and joy, the latest version of the Sirocco global positioning system, went on the blink. His co-driver Antoine Moulin took the brunt of Dubois' ire, but protested in no uncertain terms that the buck stopped with the chief driver.
"We should have had the GPS serviced."
"So where the hell are we?" said Dubois. "You were supposed to be the navigator." Moulin shrugged his shoulders. "Je m'en fous, I haven't a friggin' clue." Dubois stopped the car, got out, and glared angrily at the Mauritanian desert landscape. Nothing but sand dunes, stony bare plains, and huge red rock outcrops. "I told you we should have turned left at that rock that looked like a tortoise." "That rock looked to me like a sphinx, not a tortoise," replied Moulin, studying the map. A major row developed as they drove on. All the tensions of the preparations and then the extremely demanding rally spilled out. "Stop the car," shouted Moulin, grabbing a water bottle and a hat.
"I quit.
I'm going to walk back to that rock and get a lift with one of the backup trucks when they come. I have had it up to here with you." Dubois dismissed him with a contemptuous wave of his hand. "Va-t'en, va, cochon." The Mercedes roared off in a cloud of dust and Moulin started trudging back along the tire tracks in the searing heat. Dubois was sweating and swearing as he tried to dig the heavy murk out of the soft, deep sand drift that he had skidded off the road into. The car just seemed to sink deeper the more he dug. The sun was beginning to set, not a scrap of wood in sight to light a fire. From previous experience in the Sahara, Dubois knew how cold the desert nights get. He wrapped himself in a blanket on the back seat of the car. The wind began to howl. Next morning, the sandstorm had covered the tracks of the car. Dubois filled his water bottle from the big container and tried without success to find other receptacles for the water. He grabbed some rations and set off walking in the direction he had driven. Not a sign of habitation or vegetation. He regretted cursing the ragged lines of migrants that had encountered further back along the route. Now he longed to catch sight of another human figure in this desolate moonscape. Where were the blue-clad veiled Tuaregs on their camels? And which way should he go here, for the blasted rock forked, for the blasted track forked? The last of his water was gone, and his lips were dry and cracked when he saw the line of palm trees in the distance. He ran towards it, and as he got closer, it shimmered off into nothing. It was a day of dehydration and despair. Sand dune after sand dune, searing heat, hot wind on his face, weariness in his bones, and above all, thirst. What he would give for a mouthful of water. Then he saw it, the village, half buried in the sand, an ancient broken down village of small stone buildings. Hours later, he was at the end of his tether. A thorough search had revealed no people, no food, no water. Dowsing, he was doused for water. He broke a forked stick from a desiccated leaf of bush. And very quickly, this produced results. The stick quivered and dipped down. He scrabbled in the sand, crazy with thirst. A large, round, flat stone came into view. He heaved it to one side. Oh, well, he could smell the water. He dropped the pebble in. 3 seconds, then splash. It was a long way down the water. There was a rusty chain dangling from a ring in the side of the well. He pulled it up. The end of it was wet. But there was no bucket. And where the hell was his water bottle? Snare, he must have lost it. Only one thing for it. As he was lowering himself down, the chain snapped. He fell and plunged deep. Then rose to the surface. From there, how long could he tread water? Now he had the mouthful he had been longing for. But water was all he had. The sheer, slimy walls of the ancient well had become Jean Dubois' prison.
It's the last course part there. Thanks on there, that was really great. Julian Mann.
I have met people who live in a world of words. I have met people who live in a world of words. We swim in the pools of the old and climb the lovely mountains. For others who think of flat, the book they try to read are flat. To what they are structured like the universe. Unified, universe, unique. You and I in this world of words. Where do we hide as extraterrestrial beings? You may find us in the library, but maybe not. I will not promise you you will find one of us. It may be a harder task than finding a fairy. But fairies live in books, but we hide in them. Somewhere between the words and the story, that's where you will find us. That's where the world of words is, that's where it is, and that's where you will find us.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Ashley. Next up, we have sorry, I just can't read this. Mike O'Brien. Sorry.
So this is one that I wrote a couple of months ago. I tried to recite it verbatim until I got a massive book of stage fright. So I said I'd write it down this time around. It's called Statement by Benjamin. I just slept last night. I dreamt of our conversations and then it was BDH. But I just asked. I did find his inclusion rather strange. I never really did appreciate his work. Too depressing and simply a product of embittered times. Nonetheless, we discussed history. He said, was it this? They spread their grey wing upon every tide, for this that all that blood was shed. And it made me think about her story in the city of angels, warm yet cold, unfriendly to the touch, passionless to a passionate soul. So you cast that anchor, set those sails into the journey presented. You may indeed have to walk the plank, but then a pirate you are no more, crowned with a halo of your own morality, negating those Puritans and their ceremony. You may be a clown, battered and bruised in uncertainty, but then we're all clowns, an imperfect actor on the stage. So wipe those eyes, those tears of longing, yearning understanding, yearning home, for home is where the heart is, and the heart lies here in the motherland. Will it meet your expectations? Will you meet it head on, holding firm your values, lest they become obscured by the pirate's roar, or buried deeply in an ever-changing landscape that unsettles cabinet and prophesies by words I did not understand, from Antigone to Zedengon, to good old Iranian grave. So that's the first one, and the second one. I was in Holland over the weekend, and I went to Amsterdam, and obviously went down to the red light district, and just visited around and watched some of the kind of carry-on down the road. It was very surreal and very sterile, so I just wanted to jot down a couple of lines of what I thought about it, really. So it goes something like this, Amsterdam night. Amsterdam summer breeze, lightly caresses my skin like a kiss, fading now into distant memory, into past, into nothing. Thank you.
Yeah, so we've now entered the dreaded 3 minute warning phase where everybody's dedicated 3 minutes and no more. 3 minutes means one short poem, that's what it means. And if you go on longer than 3 minutes, I'll be pushing the ejector button there, which will open the trap door, causing to fall into the lower bar. It's real.
It's open.
Very good. Switch your watch.
The sounds of his desires are only keep it mercifully short and mercifully sweet. I don't have time for this, sorry, I'm glad to do it if I can. Romance is not dead, but poorly. The scanning and eternal wasteland, the armor of one's affections. Safety is paramount, sleeping alone, for pleasure, for fantasy, substituting yourself for risk. Unhappy love affairs, sickness, skin. Protecting from the eye's needle to which we see our own society, to the point that we need morphine. Pain is that, of course. Romance is not dead, but poorly. Taking his time to die can fill us that wish. Thanks.
Brief update.
I lay down in the street tonight, curled my face into my knees, watched the people come and go, they couldn't see me. Kitten heels, stilettos, steel cap boots, I saw all manner of footwear flash by, and I found myself a crab at the bottom of the ocean, their feet full of fish. I scuttled into a secret place, watched the world from under my rocks. All gushed and gurgled loud, but in the stills of the ocean. I wandered up their feet moving without effort, whirling through water, spinning in the streetlights where I too had done. I lay down in the street tonight, witness to myself in this spot on other days, on other nights, in other moods with other people. I watched myself tell a joke in the other's laugh. I was emaciated, but there was a little bit of sea in my eyes, and I was the audience of the room and over the forest. My applause rang a little hollow for puppet plays I'd composed for myself and others of things that did and did not happen, but could have. I lay down in the street tonight, alone in the bustling crowd of my mind with the real and the invented for bedfellows, until there was a tap on my shoulder, and I felt the warmth of her smile before I saw it. Awkwardly, wearily, as more concerned for her than myself, I rose to my feet. But you wrap your world around yourself, and I'm waking, wondered where everyone had gone. But the other me is still lying there. I curl my face tighter into my knees. My armor hangs heavy tonight. I hear my rusty wound drag against my iron breast. But then I hear a drop fall, and my heart clenches as I stretch to see the source of the sound. A single sky tear falls into the night of a puddle, and my heart fills with sky, to see yellow streams from the streetlights, to see gold in the puddle. Nature may be alone in its oneness, but it still makes the time to spend sunset. And though we cannot return the favor, we can light street lamps. I know I can rise once I've washed my face in the gold. The stream is the only one that can be sold in a world after real estate. I splash the gold on my skin and feel it course through my veins and waves. My armor is satin and has the sun shine. I know it's just for a while. I still live in nice thrall. The cliff will all crumble and the scaffold will fall. But there's the sunrise on the sunset, sunrise on the sunset, sunrise on the sunset.
Next up, David Winter.
They tell stories. Lives wrapped in yarn, narrative, ink and thin paper twisted round, dust and ash, ashe, afterbirth, and some cast stones through. Listen, tradition of speech grown past inks and transigens, holding microphones for the mouth. Memorial reconstruction of all that still lives, tales twisted to give the way a one-eyed cripple can. Something will always be returned. Entrance into ghetto, wearing poverty as clothing, ground deep into the skin. It has been mistaken for color. Children are born with very little. They grow like seeds in the cracks of sidewalks. They reach for whatever light will shine, touch it, learn its story. A street corner in Brooklyn where two men stand spinning razor blades in the air, catch them pressed beneath their tongues, pass, arc, and chew to see who slips up like an angered snake. A child will ask how this battle started. Was it where the floodlands now lie, a century before the carnage broke? Was it the bands riding wagons round down in New Orleans, kicking tunes back and forth on a Sunday, seeing how they catch lines from the air, never learned to read one note, but listen. What did they hear from their fathers, from their mothers, from old Africans buried in the belly of a ship that do not speak any longer? From nights spent, ears pressed against myth, argument, a tale with an open ending, waiting for an elder's word. Still, nothing is settled. What did they learn from three women standing in a circle, telling the same story just to see who could breathe ashe the easiest? Even if you cut the skin with a knife, carve the tree into an echo chamber, stretch one across the other and strike it with the palms of your hands, you will not have given birth to a beast. Then you may raise it as your own. Swell the base of your throat until it kicks like a child.
discipline it with the snap of your tongue, like the sound of a snare or a cane. This will not pass in your blood. It is as old as the stories told in this cipher, in this ceremony. Pay your dues to the old school, to your forefathers, to your grandmother, and that sly cripple who keeps promises. After the first break beat to Isu, he will teach you to keep a razor blade under your tongue.
Thanks, David. Thanks for being here with us. Next up, we have who's M. Casey?
Miriam.
Oh, Miriam. Sorry, Jesus.
The time. The woman sat in the doorway, and all she wore in the storm of the twilight, renewed and very grave for time. Her face was a kind of another world, the pressure of a glimmering light that portrays the length of human relationships and human truth. The man passed by the doorway with the ladies on her arms, but long ago was in 20 paces of her. She was like a beautiful piece of a masterpiece that had a life of its own, and the men watched. They watched her every move as they chatted to the ladies then, and with their pleasure in the room prepared for such questions. There are many rooms around. There was a room of play, the room of dance, the room of beauty, the room of charm. The rooms are graced with chatter and gossip. The men were filled with generosity of spirit as they drank spirits and bestowed all their attention and favor on the reach of their arms. Then with giggles and much frivolity, they smiled and touched and thought of lengths of pleasure. They descended the stairs, flushed with exertion and the joy of their enchantment. Music played, sweet and teasing. Men looked to her as they descended the stairs, but there would be no contact. A huge chasm where they could not have the liberty to hold the church, to have her in their back. Just the fan and the teasing the emptiness of all that pleasure. And they never saw the sudden darkness in her eyes, waiting behind the fan. And as time went by, the men's hearts began to grow more and more part of her. They could not move without their very thoughts being of her. They went to the room to perform their acts of desire and ecstasy. When they looked for signs within their lady's eyes of passion, it was only her they could think of. And the age was so that the dust of control of her fan, and they wanted her. And the fan seemed to have come alive. Alive in a way that no one seemed to understand. It seemed to draw them nearer, make them want to take control, to have mastery. But they remained there waiting, trying to tempt some sign from the fan. And the floor seemed to slip from under them, and they were on their knees. And they felt a deep animus in them, as they came kneeling towards her in the
dark. Thank you very much. That was great. Next up, we've got one of the most unique voice. Obviously, there are no degrees of uniqueness, you're either unique or you're not. But, one of the most. Oh, yeah, there we go. James Harrington.
Thanks, Katie. It'll be hard to live up. Mars is in the news these times. Dunleer. He studied the sky at Dunleer, proclaimed it's abundantly clear. My telescope shows it's plain as your prose. This new moon seems part of a sphere. Randall mentioned a sportsman facing the opposite direction. There is one other, and this is called Regatta Prayer. Help us, O Lord, to go straight to where we're not looking. Steer us not into temptation of looking where we're rowing amen. Current generation. Engine in the gardens, pumping in the tulips. Busy while it idles, pumping out pollution. Now another racket. Disc cuts at the concrete, sparks along the pathway, peppering red tomatoes. Evergreens don't envy this exhausting effort. Looms can hear no skylark, runner beans no walkman. Tabby's on the chimney, Jenny still putting decibels appealing to his silly lordship. Home strip caterpillars softly pleading, let us have a moment silent, frogs are slowly croaking. Eve had snapped that apple well above the ozone, claimed it was organic, Adam Stone Insider.
Very good. So that's why I said he was uniquest. Next up, we have Eugene Crowley.
Hey.
We don't have Eugene, but we do.
From Stoney, his dog, Derek Harris, he will abstain himself from dehorning, loading, feeling the same stench as the Jewish children of the Lady Way to me.
Thank you very much for that. That was actually really powerful. Actually. My vote for Poem is nice, but anyway, there's no price for that. I think someone whose work is really improving a lot, in my humble opinion, anyway. Aaron.
Okay, a friend of mine recently went back to Brittany, and on the 16th of May 2008, there was the air about me and another guy from the Czech Republic. We swam the dolphins in Rocky Bay by total chance. It was the most natural and one of the most amazing experiences of my life, so I want to read the poem that I wrote about. A dark cave, alone, light streaming through the chink. Then children of the sea dance with glee and love for being alive. Carl Jenkins, Adiamos. I walk slowly to the shore. The lap of the cool ocean baptizes my feet. I strip down to my shorts. The freezing icy water washes my body. The children in the distance still having their fun. Me back on the shore, like an ice pot getting redressed. Luke and Andre come back from their hunter-gatherer expeditions. Did you see them, I said. They look to the sea, straight in, down to boxer shorts and dreadlocks. Splash, crash, Adiamos. The slow melodic play of oboes and other woodwinds encapsulates my awe of this moment. Am I to miss out on this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity of universal expression? I plug up the courage, back to the water, crash, splash of the waves on my naked, cold, goose-pimpled body. Adiamos, Adiamos, in the background of my mind, a witness to the unfolding drama. I'm so cold, I begin to almost hyperventilate. I get out on the shore again, watching the single play of form. I'm a witness, I don't want to be. Adiamos, cymbals crash, voice caress. The music, the sounds electrify my experience. I swim out in my cold state. The keepers of the oceans come back and acknowledge our presence. They go under, around, above, jump, splash, crash. Have their fun, make their zipping noises. Adiamos, Adiamos. Paul Jenkins processing my experience, the words and music. Then Luke gets out of the water, too slim and getting cold. We stay, we're drifting out to sea. We swim back, and as we do, they come back and follow us, give us one last dance. Crescendo, a flurry of voices. We leave the ocean, and the children still dance. Tomorrow night I'm showing a film in Nancy, Spain, which is on Barracuda. It's called Coyana Scotty. It's a film made in the early 80s, made kind of from the late 70s to the early 80s. I'm showing the trilogy of this film. I'm showing the first one this week, and then the following week I'm going to show the second film, so on and forth and so forth. So I'll give you everybody a flyer before I leave tonight. But thank you. Thanks.
That was great stuff all good, Ryan. Brilliant. One of the best that I've ever heard, actually. And next up, Celine.
Hey! All in the name. I spent years trying to understand, explore, and try to know men ever since I had my first crush at the age of 10. Then I had my teenage years when I had to struggle through puberty, adolescence, and full of human fears. Whilst I was getting to know my true self and the real me, I also had to deal with emotions and what I wanted my life to be. I've always had an obsession and admiration for things surrounding love and men, and trying to find a soulmate was something I'd have to comprehend. It was never easy. Crushes, love, heartache, cycles, stalkers, and managing all the orders were sometimes enjoyment, but not always fun. From rejections being stood up and disastrous dates, and blaming misdemeanors on being just fate. Going through the glorious stages, the honeymoon period, to the turbulence of breakups and having many a cry, to reckon yourself stupid by asking and tormenting yourself why, and going out in the luck and being on the pull, ending up with some linger because you're up that pull on your phone. Or the drunken phone calls and text messages where all self-respect is gone, and whilst you think you learned from your mistakes, you still get it wrong. Ah, but now there is an answer. It's so simple and it's all the style. And all you need now to find your soulmate is just your mobile. And I think of all the years I've wasted on my journey playing the love game and the burden that it carries. If only I texted 57601 to get my soulmate's name, then now I could be married. Upon hearing this, I thought it was a bit lame. But the Adam TV says it's true because psychologists say it's all in the name. So I texted the number and I thought I'd give it a chance. It only cost me £2. But I'm not sure of my chance of meeting a fella in Reardon. By the name of Hagrid.
Perfect, guys. You will find him someday, you know that. So, I've got on the list now, there's 7 names left, which means approximately, if we go strictly by the rules, there's 30 seconds to person. But, so I'll say that by way of just asking you to be reasonably short. Like. So next we have Sean Oak.
Your bed, I saw 12 angels of golden light. One of them had a thundering trumpet, sending rays of sparkling energy flooding into me. It was the most beautiful night of my life, your gentle, sparkling, childlike smile, washing one another's naked bodies out of a basin. I missed you, my friend, I missed the laughter, I missed the crack, I want you again, but please, slow down. You are like a hurricane! Flying in the night! You scare me.
little.
I don't know.
You neither.
They are alone. But how can I win them tonight?
I was sad for you because you just don't understand and yet my fair lady. Stop.
So I didn't know what to do and I gave the Lord a call. He said, don't show your face. He did 40,000 kids.
How's that going? And that hand is gone to Ethiopia.
Something down more. Like a boom. Hey. Do you remember him down strolling? Tender once a night. Rolling down my shoulder, yellow horses flashing like lightning, flying like butterflies, dancing like a thousand days until I left his head.
Anyway, the point is, the point was, or will be, or the point will be, fucking shit.
Then the boy sang grumpy in my soul. Well, actually, I was talking to. Get out of the room, let me call him, tell him, tell him, tell him, tell him, tell him,
well, if you like to tell me, then I'll fucking scare.
Throw me that stone, and the arrow is poof.
And then along came an old yellow puffin. And then, guess what? Huh? An old witch came along too. Just on what was going on. Oh yeah, there was an old golden calf in there too. In the old equation. No, when that came around, the earth fucked that. Being an old imp, I said, screw that and walked off. Go off, it's true.
Dude, almost done.
Summer time, and the little magic I found, a golden gun. Now I'm the son of this country. The ones who have made it are sucking up dry. Let's catch those suckers before they drain us. Let's be wise and watch our back. Let's learn to speak. And I'm almost done. You can feel a little bit of uncomfortableness in the room. And create magic. Last night I went hunting. I shot the head of the Celtic tiger. Now he's hanging of a bloody rafter. And
the mind is bombarded with negative thoughts.
negative feelings for those hand in hand, supporting them, giving them power. Forces of philosophy, wise words, and reason retaliated against them, trying to suppress them. Life is a miracle, life is a miracle, live in the moment, live in the moment. Was a secret call for, get out of my system, you bastards, you're not working here. The battle between these enemies escalated, so they decided to join forces and attempt to corrupt their creator from within. Why? What the fuck is going on? Why do I read this shit? Attempt to live this kind of life. What the fuck is going on? What am I doing? What am I thinking? Meanwhile, outside, life in all its splendor of beauty, complexity and simplicity continued to unfold as the smoke and dust arose from the destruction within. What a relief when it finally died down. My whole being was thankful for the departure of the internal problems. So, so grateful. What a relief. Thank you.
Next up is someone I forgot where to go, and how could I I'm ashamed of my life that I neglected to invite you up here, Mary.
This piece isn't actually a poem, it's it's based on puns. I love puns. I didn't see anything in the papers, but I thought this would be appropriate. Monster won because they couldn't bear to lose. Anyway, this is, I think I'll... It's called Humpty Dumpty's Existentialist Monologue. Bent under the yoke of isolation on this high and windy wall, I cannot help dwelling on the problem of my girth, which alas keeps me constantly expanding. I have tried all sorts of diets, egged on by my spouse, who makes valiant efforts to cut down on my consumption. My problem is, I can never get an earth. I know. Neighbors chattering 19 to the dozen make constant comments about my weight, and while it certainly is a fertile topic of conversation, I fear that the charge of exhausting their patients may eventually be laid at my door. I follow a strict regime for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and then I chicken out. I realized I needed to exercise a lot more, take up Pilates, or go to the gym. But the last two options involve a lot of expense, and in truth, I find the whole thing too exacting. Now, my sperm count has dwindled, and Mrs. Dumpty is extremely unhappy, as the hope of future progeny might become extinct. Each time we look at a plate of scrambled eggs, she sighs, "There go my crazy mixed up kids." I know I shouldn't speak myself up about it. She has invoked the help of her hard-boiled brother. Last week, he told me if I continued to expose myself to ridicule by my gross self-indulgence, he would be forced to take drastic action. He actually said he believed I was cracking up. and suggested I leave the family home for sheltered accommodation.
We got five people left. Five treats left for us tonight, starting off with Mary Brennan.
Okay, this is like totally friendly, but anyways. In truth, we delve not into the depths of soul or thought, but further into shallowness, asphyxiating ourselves with a newer society that promised an appearance the order of our day, too far removed from our inherent journey. The plight of an insightful ancestor, the fate of those to come, lost in the abysses of our minds. And so, request no encore for this ghastly work. Life's no more than a series of contrived motifs. In time, cacophonous discomfiture. It's full of pointless monologues upon a humdrum continual. Orphan sounds from nothing to nothing, yet daring not to be unconventional. Like the soloist in a poorly written score, we are slaves to the anonymous composer, adept at playing that which is not our own. Accompanied by an orchestra of ignorance, harmony holds little importance, and the discord reaches no apparent resolution.
George, you're up, mate.
I'm still sure, right.
Hey.
I was going to bring a poem about hurling. And I thought that then who'd be interested in that, and man comes along with a book. That's the second best sport in the world. It's called Hurley Gates for Georgie. It's a book my old dad's father, who died about a year ago. And it's happened on the night. Leaving the chapel after the removal, an old man beckoned. You must be one of his daughters. You are the image of him. He'll have no problem with Peter. And pointing skyward, said, he's up there, don't worry. The gate will be wide open for him, wide open. He was one of the best. And illustrating his plays of arms as wide as he could, and reiterated, they'll be wide open, nothing shorter. And off he went into the pearly grey night. After the branches cracked and the petals faded, we finally fell. I could not say it out, not anything that you could see or tell. You lost your life with me. I was weak, there never was another space where we could be just one. You never saw me standing by a gate that was open, a place where my shivering hand would reach out and grasp the handle to put an end to all that consuming doubt. You could not grab the nettle, I could not bear the sting, been inflicted, slowly there to settle and leave our hearts in sling. Thank you.
And next up, another O'Vale stalwart, it's Jean Barry.
Hey!
Thanks, Andrew, for a wonderful reading tonight, and Sean. It's felt very Sean, I think. Well done, really enjoyed both of them. Thanks. I was up at the UCC 40 day last Friday, and Eileen McCullinan was reading, and she read a poem from one of her collections about Belsborough. which is a convent, the nun factory, whatever, down in Black Rock, where unmarried teenagers and women in the 40s, 50s, all the way up to the 90s were banished for having children out of wedlock, and where their babies were basically amputated from them and their futures and just given away to people, you know. And I remember being down there with 14 years of age, hanging around where the tide used to come in and nesting down there, and I remember it was the first time I realised that the gates there were to keep people in, not keep people out, and a lot of discoveries around the place. So when I got home Friday night, I wrote this poem anyway. I brought in the candles tonight actually, which is burning here with him, and it's burning every week, specifically for all of those mothers and children that suffer there. And I just want to light it every week in here in their honour. And I call the poem The Red Brick Womb, and it's for everybody who suffered in Israel. So. The limestone keepers that broadcast the unheard held them in a callous red brick womb, whispering pairs whose feast was a fearful stolen ear. I often strolled on the side where freedom had never lived, where the white-collared offender gasped. I used to dream that the unwelcome St. Peter's kept us out, that their family's gypsum ebbed each new pair awash with unpacked baggage. I saw myself so many times dip both tongues in the delivery tide and swim upstream to town after unknown town, to the wicked cleansed and obedient, the wounded list in tow. I surfaced to audience of crime, where I lashed them with strings of conscience, to places where I amputated the Christian masks of punishment, to where I beat the ambient dose with frame after frame of reality. Years later, when I invitingly stood in their polished parlor, absorbing the starched smiles, I heard the swings of conscience lashed. I listened to the euphoric torments of the smiling baby stealers, and I filled my scabbard and buried my anger in forgiveness. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. When are you going to be doing this? Come on, you know. So, the last participant now tonight, as usual, it's something of a tradition that the singing professor would, would round things off here a little bit. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Billy.
Thanks for that. This again is another short fable. It's for Edward actually, because he'll know why when I read it. It's called Progress. There was a perfectly happy man who lived underneath a tree. He ate the fruit and the nuts that fell often and in abundance into his lap. He was never hungry. He never had to stir a limb, nor shake a leg, nor wiggle an extremity, except when he had to answer a call of nature. One day a student came his way. He was studying business and entrepreneurship in the University of Limerick and walked with a swagger as if he was a Cork hurler. Look, he said to the lazy dot underneath the tree, look at the great and wonderful opportunity you are missing to make money and get on in the world. Instead of eating this fruit and chewing these nuts, why don't you collect them all together and sell them to the shops or at the market or at the fair? Or even better than that, why don't you plant some of them in the ground so that the other trees might grow and more fruit would fall and greater nuts would come and you could even make a bigger and a better profit? And why do you want to do that? Said the lazy man under the tree or the half-closed eye. So that you would make money, of course. And why would I want to make money? Even though the student from the University of Limerick, who realised some academic politics in this, didn't really understand the question, he tried to answer it as best he could because the education which he received hadn't quite erased or banished the good manners which he naturally possessed. Well, said the student, if you had enough money, you could do anything at all you liked. Maybe even you wouldn't have to do anything at all. You could be idle all day long. You could rest and take it easy. And what do you think I'm doing now? The man who lives under the tree.